Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to a recording about Miguel Sabido's soap operas. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below, then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer for questions 1 to 8. Put a cross in the correct box. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
We're devoting this part of the show to awareness, which nearly everyone wants to raise about something. The direct approach is to write up the chosen issue in a press release and hope the media respond. But that's a chancy proposition at best, so other avenues are explored. Take soap operas. They engage the hearts and minds of millions. In the mid-1960s, Miguel Sabido was just a Mexican TV scriptwriter, grinding out cliffhangers for the hugely popular primetime soaps called telenovelas. But suddenly, a progressive Peruvian telenovela, Simple Maria, became a national craze, pulling more viewers than even the last game of the World Cup. Simple Maria defied stereotype by taking control of her own destiny, and in her storyline, Sabido saw a chance to instruct and inspire millions. Thus, the Sabido Method was born. Since the 1970s, Sabido's recipe has been exported around the globe, and several organizations have become torchbearers. Hannah Rosen wrote about Sabido for The New Yorker, and she joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what is the Sabido method and how is it different from the standard method of creating a telenovela?
Well, women in Latin America at a certain level in the standard telenovela, there's no idea that they should break out of the societal mode. Usually it's a woman and visited upon her all sorts of tragedies and amnesia and infidelity. And then she just kind of drifts back into that cycle again, into sort of another doomed marriage and, you know, looks for her redemption and romance. A Sabido telenovela completely subverts that formula. While not losing the central romance and titillation of a telenovela, it tries to have one of the characters, at least, break out of those traditional social roles. And it's a character who people are supposed to identify with. So it's a character of lower class who looks like everyone and isn't sort of a blonde bombshell or something like that.
How well have these stories translated from country to country? You wrote about Sabido's efforts in India, Burma, Nepal. What worked and what didn't?
Well, that's a lesson that's come hard to them. And it's been a slow trial and error process of trying to get a local voice, but not a local voice that's completely reflecting all the local values. So actually, they have to do a lot of specific training country to country, which a group, Population Communications International, which I wrote about, that's one of the things they do, is do trainings for screenwriters and radio producers.
Tell me about Population Communications International.
PCI, as it calls itself, was started to work on population control around the world, and then telenovelas became its specialty, and it gets its funding from all sorts of places, sometimes from the U.S. government, sometimes from the U.N., and sometimes from small organizations locally.
I think the thing that struck me the most is the demonstrable impact of Sabido's telenovelas on people's behavior all around the world. And I guess one of the clearest examples involved a radio telenovela in Tanzania.
Yes, Tanzania was one of the most interesting studies they did because they cut off a certain area of the country from radio transmission for 2 years and measured the difference in how many people, for example, used family planning or took AIDS drugs in the section of the country that did not have the program and the sections that did.
So how big was the difference from region to region?
There was bigger differences in attitudes. So there was sort of 60% differences in attitudes in terms of acceptability of HIV testing and acceptability of certain ideas about children and what children represented. And then in terms of actual behavior, it was on the order of sort of 25-30% in terms of whether people actually requested certain drugs, requested tests, or requested certain forms of birth control.
We're devoting this part of the show to awareness, which nearly everyone wants to raise about something. The direct approach is to write up the chosen issue in a press release and hope the media respond. But that's a chancy proposition at best, so other avenues are explored. Take soap operas. They engage the hearts and minds of millions. In the mid-1960s, Miguel Sabido was just a Mexican TV scriptwriter, grinding out cliffhangers for the hugely popular primetime soaps called telenovelas. But suddenly, a progressive Peruvian telenovela, Simple Maria, became a national craze, pulling more viewers than even the last game of the World Cup. Simple Maria defied stereotype by taking control of her own destiny, and in her storyline, Sabido saw a chance to instruct and inspire millions. Thus, the Sabido Method was born. Since the 1970s, Sabido's recipe has been exported around the globe, and several organizations have become torchbearers. Hannah Rosen wrote about Sabido for The New Yorker, and she joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what is the Sabido method and how is it different from the standard method of creating a telenovela?
Well, women in Latin America at a certain level in the standard telenovela, there's no idea that they should break out of the societal mode. Usually it's a woman and visited upon her all sorts of tragedies and amnesia and infidelity. And then she just kind of drifts back into that cycle again, into sort of another doomed marriage and, you know, looks for her redemption and romance. A Sabido telenovela completely subverts that formula. While not losing the central romance and titillation of a telenovela, it tries to have one of the characters, at least, break out of those traditional social roles. And it's the character who people are supposed to identify with. So it's a character of lower class who looks like everyone and isn't sort of a blonde bombshell or something like that.
How well have these stories translated from country to country? I mean, you wrote about Sabido's efforts in India, Burma, Nepal. What worked and what didn't?
Well, that's a lesson that's come hard to them. And it's been a slow trial and error process of trying to get a local voice, but not a local voice that's completely reflecting all the local values. So actually, they have to do a lot of specific training country to country, which a group, Population Communications International, which I wrote about, that's one of the things they do, is do trainings for screenwriters and radio producers.
Tell me about Population Communications International.
PCI, as it calls itself, was started to work on population control around the world, and then telenovelas became its specialty, and it gets its funding from all sorts of places, sometimes from the U.S. government, sometimes from the U.N., and sometimes from small organizations locally.
I think the thing that struck me the most is the demonstrable impact of Sabido's telenovelas on people's behavior all around the world. And I guess one of the clearest examples involved a radio telenovela in Tanzania.
Yes, Tanzania was one of the most interesting studies they did because they cut off a certain area of the country from radio transmission for 2 years and measured the difference in how many people, for example, used family planning or took AIDS drugs in the section of the country that did not have the program and the sections that did.
So how big was the difference from region to region?
There was bigger differences in attitudes. So there was sort of 60% differences in attitudes in terms of acceptability of HIV testing and acceptability of certain ideas about children and what children represented. And then in terms of actual behavior, it was on the order of sort of 25-30% in terms of whether people actually requested certain drugs, requested tests, or requested certain forms of birth control.
Task 2. You are going to listen to a recording about the band U2. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below, then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences, 9 to 16, with the sentence endings, A to K. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
I recently visited a rehearsal studio in Dublin to watch a band at work, arranging harmony parts and tightening up stray rhythms. The musicians in the room, Bono, The Edge, Larry Mullen and Adam Clayton, first played together more than 30 years ago in a school gymnasium. These days, they're the biggest band in the world, one which routinely fills stadiums and recently performed by presidential request. Soon after the Obama inauguration, U2 returned to their hometown to prepare for the release of their 12th studio album, No Line on the Horizon. In a break from rehearsals, I started by asking singer Bono about his pre-U2 identity, Paul Hewson. Why did he rename himself?
I think what it really was just big monumental arguments with my old man. You know, that's really what it was. I won't have the name you chose for me. I think it was that. I mean, I think it was, it goes back to that. We name ourselves. We won't take that with us.
And when you first hooked up with the other three guys, or the four of you came together in a room, how long before you knew something special was going on? And could you ever foresee in those early days that it would last, it would have this longevity?
Well, I think we gave an impromptu gig. Well, there was was it a talent contest? Or it was like an end of term thing in the school gym. We talked them into letting us do some tunes.
Bassist Adam Clayton.
We'd written something. We did a couple of cover versions.
We did Peter Frampton, a song called Show Me the Way. And I would try singing, you know, various other people that we looked up to at the time. Rolling Stones, High Tide, Greengrass, we had all that early Rolling Stones. There was a bit of that sort of early punk was just breaking. We were into the Beach Boys, we were into sort of kind of Chuck Berry and that kind of thing. But this song arrived, Show Me the Way. And I sang it, and suddenly my voice started to make sense, because it was just a really crap voice, except in that song. And it's strange, because I only recently was in Chicago doing some work with AIDS activists, and I met this guy. He was just one in the room, like a lot of people, just doing work in the local community. And it was Peter Frampton. And he said, I was in a band. And I was in a band. You're one of the great British guitar players. And then you were one of the biggest stars on earth. And what are you doing now? He said, I'm not into that. I'm just working. I'm really blah, blah, blah. And then I just had to sort of say to him, I said, actually, your song it gave me a kind of a sense that I could sing a song at all. He said, wow, that song? I said, I've never heard that. I said, I don't think I've ever told anyone. And because you weren't loud like Peter Frampton in the days of punk rock, so we quickly forgot that one. Part of the Cultural Revolution, you know. It's like, Mao. No! No! No, Peter Frampton! No! G!
During our interview, Bono revealed that he had descended from a succession of travelling salesmen on his mother's side. He said he felt that, in a way, he was carrying on the family tradition with a dual career, the peddler of both songs and political ideas, like debt cancellation. As Wall Street crashed last year, he shared a platform with Bill Clinton, Al Gore and Bill Gates.
It is extraordinary to me that you can find $700 billion to save Wall Street, and the entire G8 can't find $25 billion to save 25,000 children who die every day of preventable, treatable disease and hunger. That's mad. That is mad.
At last week's Labour Party conference, the rock star Bono was invited to make an impassioned speech on Africa.
The Pope has met the rock star Bono and other celebrities to give his public backing to a campaign to end third world debt.
The reason that people, politicians, let me in their offices is not because I know what I'm talking about, which I do, and I can communicate those ideas quite well. They let me in because I'm in U2, and we have a big audience, and they're afraid of our audience. Because if our audience, if they disrespect me, or if they don't take the meeting, they don't want to, you know, politicians need, they need to get elected. And it's a very big audience. And outside of the U2 audience, then there's the music audience.
I recently visited a rehearsal studio in Dublin to watch a band at work, arranging harmony parts and tightening up stray rhythms. The musicians in the room, Bono, The Edge, Larry Mullen and Adam Clayton, first played together more than 30 years ago in a school gymnasium. These days, they're the biggest band in the world, one which routinely fills stadiums and recently performed by presidential request. Soon after the Obama inauguration, U2 returned to their hometown to prepare for the release of their 12th studio album, No Line on the Horizon. In a break from rehearsals, I started by asking singer Bono about his pre-U2 identity, Paul Hewson. Why did he rename himself?
I think what it really was just big monumental arguments with my old man. You know, that's really what it was. I won't have the name you chose for me. I think it was that. I mean, I think it was, if I, you know, it goes back to that. We name ourselves. We won't take that with us.
And when you first hooked up with the other three guys, or the four of you came together in a room, how long before you knew something special was going on? And could you ever foresee in those early days that it would last, it would have this longevity?
Well, I think we gave an impromptu gig. Well, there was a talent contest, or it was like an end of term thing in the school gym. We talked them into letting us do some tunes.
Bassist Adam Clayton.
We'd written something. We did a couple of cover versions.
We did Peter Frampton, a song called Show Me the Way. And I would try singing, you know, various other people that we looked up to at the time. Rolling Stones, High Tide, Greengrass. We had all that early Rolling Stones. That sort of early punk was just breaking. We were into the Beach Boys. We were into sort of kind of Chuck Berry and that kind of thing. But this song arrived, Show Me the Way. And I sang it, and suddenly my voice started to make sense, because it was just a really crap voice, except in that song. And it's strange, because I only recently was in Chicago doing some work with AIDS activists, and I met this guy. He was just one in the room, like a lot of people, just doing work in the local community. And it was Peter Frampton. And he said, I was in a band. And I was in a band. You were one of the great British guitar players. And then you were one of the biggest stars on earth. And what are you doing now? He said, I'm not into that. I'm just working. I'm really blah, blah, blah. And then I just had to sort of say to him, I said, actually, your song gave me a kind of a a sense that I could sing a song at all. And he said, wow, that song? I said, you know, I've never heard that. I said, I don't think I've ever told anyone. And because you weren't loud like Peter Frampton in the days of punk rock, so we quickly forgot that one. Part of the Cultural Revolution, you know. It's like, Mao. No! No! No, Peter Frampton! No!
During our interview, Bono revealed that he had descended from a succession of travelling salesmen on his mother's side. He said he felt that, in a way, he was carrying on the family tradition with a dual career, the peddler of both songs and political ideas, like debt cancellation. As Wall Street crashed last year, he shared a platform with Bill Clinton, Al Gore and Bill Gates.
It is extraordinary to me that you can find $700 billion to save Wall Street and the entire G8 can't find $25 billion to save 25,000 children who die every day of preventable, treatable disease and hunger. That's mad. That is mad.
At last week's Labour Party conference, the rock star Bono was invited to make an impassioned speech on Africa.
The Pope has met the rock star Bono and other celebrities to give his public backing to a campaign to end third world debt.
The reason that people, politicians, let me in their offices is not because I know what I'm talking about, which I do, and I can communicate those ideas quite well. They let me in because I'm in U2, and we have a big audience, and they're afraid of our audience. Because if our audience, if they disrespect me, or if they don't take the meeting, they don't want to, you know, politicians need, they need to get elected. And it's a very big audience. And outside of the U2 audience, then there's the music audience.
Task 3. You are going to listen to a recording about elephants in zoos. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, answer the questions 17 to 23 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Seven minutes to nine. Are we about to see elephants disappearing from Britain's zoos? That's what the RSPCA wants to happen. There's new research that shows elephants in zoos have a very short life. Dr. Rob Atkinson of the RSPCA is on the line. Miranda Stevenson, who runs the British and Irish Association of Zoos and Aquariums, is with me. What is the evidence, Dr. Atkinson?
Well, it confirms what we were told in 2002, that these animals are living very short lifespans. African elephants, a third of the life that they would have in the wild. Asian elephants, a half the life they would have in logging camps. 58% of babies dying before they're one. And high incidence of lameness, 70% lame. 80% have got foot problems. 16% have only 16% walk normally, and nearly all of them are overweight.
And this is because of the conditions in which they're kept? I mean, does it vary from zoo to zoo?
It probably does, but it is because of the conditions in which they're kept. And one of the most shocking figures from the science report was that actually being born in a zoo reduces your chances of survival.
That sounds very odd, doesn't it? You think quite the opposite.
Exactly, yeah. That compares with animals that were taken from the wild. So these are babies who are taken away from their mother, often broken quite brutally, transported into a cold climate, and those ones do better than the ones that were born in zoos.
Well, how do you explain that?
Something profoundly wrong is happening. Could well be to do with stress, that the environment is so unnatural for these socially complex animals, and it could be also to do with the husbandry of them, you know, hard floors, right. Very small spaces.
Right, well, let's put that to Miranda Stevenson. What are you going to do about it?
Well, it's not so much what we are going to do about it, it's what we are doing about it. We produced husbandry guidelines in 2002. We upgraded these and updated them in 2006. And our members, which are the 14 zoos in Britain and Ireland, have to comply with these guidelines. What Rob didn't mention was that we were one of the co-funders, along with the RSPCA, of the DEFRA research that's just been carried out, that's, I think, on the website this morning. And so one of our reasons for being the co-funders of this was that we actually want to get evidence so that we can improve our husbandry guidelines and resolve some of the problems in the way that Rob has described it. So we're being active. We're actively doing something. I'm rather surprised that the RSPCA don't approve of us being proactive.
Well, because
they are a welfare association.
Well, because what you can't do is replicate the environment in which they would live in the wild, either the social environment or the natural physical environment. You can't do that in a zoo, can you? With the best will in the world.
We can do it to a certain extent.
Limited extent.
Well, what you have to remember about the wild is that the distance elephants move in the wild is to find food. In the captive situation, we provide the food, but they obviously, we have to encourage them to take more exercise and to move
how
more.
How can they have vast animals? You don't have hundreds and thousands of acres for them to roam around in.
We don't, but we can exercise them, we can take them for walks, and we can make them forage for their food. And in fact, the new elephant enclosures, most of which actually have been built in the last 3 to 5 years, have got facilities in them to encourage elephants to do this, and also better substrates, and that's key to the whole
thing.
But
if they are dying such early deaths, then it's clearly wrong to keep them in captivity,
well,
isn't it?
This is mainly because of problems with young animals dying.
Seven minutes to 9. Are we about to see elephants disappearing from Britain's zoos? That's what the RSPCA wants to happen. There's new research that shows elephants in zoos have a very short life. Dr. Rob Atkinson of the RSPCA is on the line. Miranda Stevenson, who runs the British and Irish Association of Zoos and Aquariums, is with me. What is the evidence, Dr. Atkinson?
Well, it confirms what we were told in 2002, that these animals are living very short lifespans. African elephants, a third of the life that they would have in the wild. Asian elephants, a half the life they would have in logging camps. 58% of babies dying before they're one. And high incidence of lameness, 70% lame. 80% have got foot problems. 16% have only 16% walk normally, and nearly all of them are overweight.
And this is because of the conditions in which they're kept? I mean, does it vary from zoo to zoo?
It probably does, but it is because of the conditions in which they're kept. And one of the most shocking figures from the science report was that actually being born in a zoo reduces your chances of survival.
That sounds very odd, doesn't it? You think
odd.
Quite the opposite.
Exactly, yeah. That compares with animals that were taken from the wild. So these are babies who are taken away from their mother, often broken quite brutally, transported into a cold climate, and and those ones do better than the ones that were born in zoos.
Well, how something do you explain that?
Something profoundly wrong is happening. It could well be to do with stress, that the environment is so unnatural for these socially complex animals, and it could be also to do with the husbandry of them, you know, hard floors, right. Very small spaces.
Right, well, let's put that to Miranda Stevenson. What are you going to do about it?
Well, it's not so much what we are going to do about it, it's what we are doing about it. We produced husbandry guidelines in 2002. We upgraded these and updated them in 2006. And our members, which are the 14 zoos in Britain and Ireland, have to comply with these guidelines. What Rob didn't mention was that we were one of the co-funders, along with the RSPCA, of the DEFRA research that's just been carried out, that's, I think, on the website this morning. And so one of our reasons for being the co-funders of this was that we actually want to get evidence so that we can improve our husbandry guidelines and resolve some of the problems in the way that Rob has described it. But we're being active. We're actively doing something. I'm rather surprised that the RSPCA don't approve of us being proactive. Well, because, they are a welfare association.
Well, because what you can't do is replicate the environment in which they would live in the wild, either the social environment or the natural physical environment. You can't do that in a zoo, can you? With the best will in the world.
We can do it to a certain extent.
Limited extent.
Well, what you have to remember about the wild is that the distance elephants move in the wild is to find food. In the captive situation, we provide the food, but they obviously, we have to encourage them to take more exercise and to move more.
How can they have vast animals? You don't have hundreds and thousands of acres for them to roam around in.
We don't, but we can exercise them, we can take them for walks, and we can make them forage for their food. And in fact, the new elephant enclosures, most of which actually have been built in the last 3 to 5 years, have got facilities in them to encourage elephants to do this, and also better substrates, and that's key to the whole thing as well.
But if they are dying such early deaths, then it's clearly wrong to keep them in captivity,
well,
isn't it?
This is mainly because of problems with young animals dying.
Task 4. You are going to listen to a recording about London's Natural History Museum. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below, then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, complete the sentences 24 to 29 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
We're standing now in a science lab space, but we're looking through 2 panes of glass at the wonderful atrium space with the 8-story-high, 65-metre-long cocoon. What is of interest here is you can see 2 of the windows from the cocoon from which our visitors will be able to see from the public exhibition space actually into science labs and see what's going on within those spaces. Something that we're very keen to do is to metaphorically throw open the doors so that people can see what historically has been going on behind the scenes at the Natural History Museum.
One of the key things is the public involvement. How important is it to get the message across and get people involved?
It's very important. We regard it as a publicly funded institution, as our role to contribute to increasing levels of scientific literacy. We have a very strong secondary science program here, where demonstrably we're affecting young people's career choice. You will be aware, of course, that there is a shortage of scientists being trained in this country, and the potential problems that that will create for our economy if it's not addressed. And we see it as a fundamental part of our role to inspire young people to consider science as a career, to see scientists in this institution, see them as role models, see them as not the kind of stereotypes that sometimes scientists are portrayed as in the media.
What do you make of science coverage in the media at the moment?
I think two things. One is historically, perhaps, there is a difficulty in making science accessible to general readers. And I think the skills that people develop in communicating complex science ideas to lay people is something that we're developing a great deal of expertise at here at the museum, and that can only be for the good. I think the other thing to say is that there is a burgeoning public interest in scientific issues, particularly around things like climate change and the impact of climate change on the natural world. So I think these two positive things should come together, and I hope over time we'll see higher standards of presentation of science in all forms of the media. We're standing now in a science lab space, but we're looking through two panes of glass at the wonderful atrium space with the 8-story high, 65-meter long cocoon. What is of interest here is you can see two of the windows from the cocoon from which our visitors will be able to see from the public exhibition space actually into science labs and see what's going on within those spaces. Something that we're very keen to do is to metaphorically throw open the doors so that people can see what historically has been going on behind the scenes at the Natural History Museum.
One of the key things is the public involvement. How important is it to get the message across and get people involved?
It's very important. We regard it as a publicly funded institution, as our role to contribute to increasing levels of scientific literacy. We have a very strong secondary science program here, where demonstrably we're affecting young people's career choice. You will be aware, of course, that there is a shortage of scientists being trained in this country, and the potential problems that that will create for our economy if it's not addressed. And we see it as a fundamental part of our role to inspire young people to consider science as a career, to see scientists in this institution, see them as role models, see them as not the kind of stereotypes that sometimes scientists are portrayed as in the media.
What do you make of science coverage in the media at the moment?
I think two things. One is historically, perhaps, there is a difficulty in making science accessible to general readers. And I think the skills that people develop in communicating complex science ideas to lay people is something that we're developing a great deal of expertise at here at the museum, and that can only be for the good. I think the other thing to say is that there is a burgeoning public interest in scientific issues, particularly around things like climate change and the impact of climate change on the natural world. So I think these two positive things should come together, and I hope over time we'll see higher standards of presentation of science in all forms of the media.
This is the end of the listening test.